The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Sustainable finance for growing places. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. We'll talk to Busi Mavuso. It's been a while since we last caught up with Busi, about a plan to connect private and public sector to help enable the state to do its job better. We'll talk about that this evening. We'll also get an explanation for you about why it is that Rain got a big fat smack on the wrist yesterday when it announced its plans to talk to Telkom about a potential tie-up. And it hasn't even made the approach yet, not even formally so. Telkom this morning issued a statement saying if they do, we'll talk to them. No problem. And then, just to add luster to the cluster, as they say, after MTN announced about 2 weeks ago that it was keen on buying Telkom, we then had Rain yesterday saying we'd like to do a deal. And then Toto Investment Holdings is looking to rain on the parade even further. And it is looking to buy government stakes. So we'll pick up on that this evening. We'll play the Brutal Biz quiz. We'll wrap up today's activity on markets. We'll talk about Mondi's decision to begin its exit of Russia. We'll also talk about a huge week, which has been, I suppose, the catalyst of which was the fact that inflation in the United States has started to begin to soften. That is what's on our agenda this evening. I don't know what's on yours. If you'd like to tell us what's on yours and you'd like to share it with us, you could do so on 011-883-0702. You could tweet us at Bruce Business or a WhatsApp on 072-702-1702. Love to hear from you this evening. If you think your brand or your product, by the way, is indestructible, if you've got this great idea, everybody loves you, everybody tells you how wonderful you are, everyone tells you what a good idea you have, well done you. One of the world's most famous products is being discontinued from next year because of unproven claims that it causes ovarian cancer. Now, it doesn't take much to destroy a global brand in the most interconnected world in which we've ever lived. And when I tell you, you'll immediately smell it, this product. You know the smell. Childhood memories, maybe for you, or maybe if you've had a happy moment of a post-bath nappy change, you'll know Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder. Well, Johnson & Johnson's going to stop making talc-based baby powder around the world from next year. It's already stopped selling it in the United States. It comes 2 years after it was accused of the product causing ovarian cancer in women. People claimed it contained asbestos. The company's always denied that it claimed contained asbestos, always claimed that the product is 100% safe. Yet the damage is done. The global campaign against the product means it is over. Talcum powder, as you note, that sweet-smelling after-bath baby smell is no longer. Maybe they'll recreate it in a cornstarch-based powder. Will it ever be the same again? I wonder.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
How often is it something big is announced on high within your organization and you've turned to a colleague and you've said, oh, that'll never work. These guys don't know what they're doing. Because either it's because it's a terrible idea, maybe you've seen it tried before, or it's an idea that simply failed to get buy-in from all of the parties that are supposed to make it work. Well, a really good idea this week, a collaboration between private sector and the National Prosecuting Authority to help it build greater capability to do the prosecutions that are necessary to make it appear that we're getting on the right track as a country. But will it get the necessary buy-in to allow it to work? Busi Mavuso is the Chief Executive at Business Leadership South Africa. You signed this Memorandum of Understanding, Busi. How is that actually going to translate into action?
Bruce, good evening. We have actually, as business, agreed and committed to support the NPA with the technical skills that they require to be able to mount effective prosecutions. And we have done this because we understand and we appreciate, and it has come out over and over again in the many conversations that we have had with Shamila Patoy herself and some of her deputies, that the private sector has the skills that they require as the NPA to be able to put together very strong cases to enable them to get some of the successful prosecutions. But also, Bruce, the private sector has good capacity in complex investigations and the legal minds to draw together the evidence to support the successful prosecutions. So it makes sense that the private sector should actually be coming to the party and see how, now that we've got all the Zondo reports, you know, that have come out, which clearly give us the evidence that we need to be able to, or at least point us in the right direction, you know, to be able to start putting together some of these cases. If the private sector doesn't actually put up their hand to assist the NPA, then who will, right? So I think it is from that perspective that we're doing it. But also, Bruce, it is a strategic priority of Business Leadership South Africa to support the recovery of the criminal justice system. We know that a lot of these institutions, the criminal justice system in particular, was the main focus of the State Capture Project. And over the years, it has been terribly hollowed out. And they are therefore sitting at the moment without the necessary capacity to be able to do their job. And it is really from this perspective that we started having this discussion with Shamila from some time back. Only, I think, at the beginning of the year, you know, I think they came around as an institution to say that we think now we are ready and are willing to actually accept the assistance from the private sector.
It really is a very noble and good idea. The question is, do you get buy-in across the organization? Because Shamila Batoy, for all the best will in the world, is not the person who's going to make this work. This is going to be down to 1,000 people, 2,000 people, 3,000 people who are already within the corridors of the National Prosecuting Authority, some of whom may be quite resistant to this idea. How are we going to get buy-in to ensure that it actually gets adopted, that people are welcomed rather than ostracized when they arrive and they try to make an impact and just destroys morale completely? How do we ensure that it actually works?
Yeah. So, Bruce, I think as an initial indicator to know or to ascertain that we've got buy-in, we have buy-in from the presidency. I think the president himself has spoken a lot about how business assists in terms of enabling a capable state. And I think he has spoken to the issue of the National Prosecuting Authority capacitation in particular. We have buy-in from the National Treasury. We've had conversations with the Minister of Finance where he has actually requested specifically business to actually come to the party as far as this is concerned. But we also have buy-in, you know, from the NPA itself. You know, I think they sat with this memorandum of understanding, I think, for the last 6 months, because the last conversation we had with them was at the beginning of the year after the first Zondo report came out. And I think they really needed to take time to put this MOU together so that it suits how they work as an institution. It aligns with their processes, it aligns with their systems, and they really create a space of how they're actually going to be bringing in these private sector people to enable them to do what they need to do. So in principle and at the right levels, there is that support. And I think in putting this together, obviously, proves that obviously had conversations with the divisions, the departments, the head of departments that are actually going to be receiving these skills. And I think their articulation of precisely what skills they need at what levels, how many of those skills for how long, would have come from the head of department. So it would be difficult for me, you know, for them to sit together and take all this trouble and all this time and effort to put together such a comprehensive document which really articulates what they require, only to actually displace those people once they actually get to the NPA. So I think we've taken the necessary time to put this together and the necessary guardrails, Bruce, to ensure that this is not business imposing its knowledge on the NPA. Look, actually, I think Shamila is very clear, and I agree with her, that when it comes to prosecutors, you know, the NPA has got the best prosecuting team in the country, or the best prosecutors in the country. So the support that is really required is precisely that, you know, what skills and what systems and what knowledge and expertise do they actually require that is not currently inside the NPA that will enable them to actually put together comprehensive cases. And I think our people will really be going in supporting the prosecutors. So I think that relationship will work.
Do we have a time frame on this, Boosie? When can we expect the first people from the private sector to arrive at the NPA and say, right, let's go?
So, Bruce, we have actually said as one of the guardrails that we will allow the request to come from the NPA. We are actually going to be directed from by them in terms of what they require, when, and how many of them. So we don't want to actually, it's going to be a, pull exercise instead of a push exercise, because then we'll end up, you know, pushing people into their environment that they probably maybe don't need at the moment, people that will sit there and not be utilized effectively, and all of those issues. So we have already received the first two requests on Wednesday, and I think they've actually given us the actual job specifications.
Oh, good.
So I think you can expect that, you can expect that at least in the next 2 weeks, we'll actually make sure that these people, if not long, I think this will also depend on how quickly we can actually make these people available. And I think if these are entry-level people that are required, then it's very easy. You know, you've got lists of these people in the Yes Initiative. You've got lists of these people in Harambee, you know, institutions which are already standing ready and willing to actually supply these skills. And if, you know, obviously these are at partner level, then it might take a little bit of time for us to actually be able to avail the skills. But we are already working on it as BLSA and we're busy processing that request.
Busi Mavuso, good news. Thank you very much indeed.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I love a use of the term guardrails to protect the thing from falling over. If you've played 10-pin bowling, you know how important those can be. How many mergers and acquisitions fail? I mean, certainly there's a lot of interest in South Africa's telecommunications sector at the moment, particularly in telecom. Investment firm Toto, the latest to say it's interested in a bit of telecom. It's approached government to buy its 40.5% stake in telecom. It's the third firm to express an interest in the telecoms provider, which is part owned by government and part owned by private shareholders listed on the JSE. MTN wants the whole thing. Rain wants a merger, and Toto wants the government's stake. Government playing it cool, saying it's got no plans to sell. Now, Toto is interesting. It's the latest potential suitor for assets that belong to Telkom, founded by Bongani Gigaba, an economist and later chief of staff at National Treasury for 6 years until 1999, and briefly returned as a consultant to the presidency for about 18 months until 2012, but has been running Toto since the global financial crisis. He previously tried to acquire SAA, that was rejected. It's part of a consortium that owns nearly a quarter of Richards Bay Minerals. So this is a serious individual and a serious organization. I did suggest when MTN first made its pitch for Telkom that the floodgates might just open, and they are opening. Amor Berger-Smit is director at Worksman's Attorneys. It's been a while since there's been a contest over a South African asset, Amor. It's quite exciting.
Indeed, Bruce, thank you for having me. And yes, what the suitors are lining up for this bride, and the question is how willing the bride would be to entertain which suitor. So indeed, interesting times. I think the last time we've experienced this was around about 7-8 years back, when we had all the potential merger activity with Vodacom and Newtel and MTN and Telkom.
Yep, lots of excitement in the market. The rules around takeovers, though, are incredibly strict. And a lot of people were quite surprised by the fact that something called the Takeover Regulation Panel got involved yesterday and shouted at Rain for issuing a statement they said was illegal and should not have been issued. This is something that's existed for as long as I can remember anyway, the TRP, the Takeover Regulation Panel. Just take me through it briefly as to what the high-level rules are when it comes to multiple parties wanted to buy the same business?
Well, I think, you know, the Rain concern that the TRP raised not in itself relates to the fact that there are multiple parties, but more in terms of process, Bruce. Now, in short, there's a TRP code that regulates company acquisitions, and if you're a public company acquisitions, and if you want to acquire more than a 35% stake in another entity, you trigger this code. It's referred to as affected transaction. So the moment, and the code prescribes what you have to do, so the moment there is a firm intention letter on the table, i.e. I put it letter on the table to say I want to acquire 35% of or more of your entity, you know, that you are obliged to put a sense announcement out. And this TRP code regulations, that's the issue why the TRP raised concerns. So no one knows at this stage, from everything that's been said in the public, whether such a firm intention letter has been presented. And therefore, the TRP instructed for the sense announcement to be withdrawn.
Okay, so we got a situation where so far, at least, there are three very different approaches. Is it up to the board to decide, or does the board have to go, because this is a state, partly state-owned enterprise, does the board have to go to the Department of Communications, or does the board have the final say as to how this particular party plays out?
Well, the board has to decide which constitutes the most attractive offer and the most valuable offer for the stakeholders. But looking at the regulatory environment, not only do we look at ICASA as a regulator, because there could potentially be a change in ownership of a license, we look at the competition authorities for approval and whether there is a trigger in terms of control. And I think it is more on the competition authority side that these transactions have been tripped up over and over the years. And, you know, in that instance, it's interesting to consider the three parties, because the first thing the competition authorities have to do, besides all the focus on public interest, is to assess whether this transaction is good or bad for competition. You know, will there be a limiting or a significant limiting or substantial preventing of competition or lessening of competition, or will a transaction landscape? And that would be the question to be considered. And the most vital.
And we're being let down by telecommunications, talking about telecommunications. But Amor, thank you for making the point. Amor Berger-Smit, director at Worksmen's Attorneys. Yep, who would have thought it? Who would have thunk it 10 days ago that there'd be three contesting parties looking for different bits of telecom? There may be more. We watch the space very, very closely. In a moment, David Peacock, he is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, as we wrap up today's activity on the markets, including a restructure of Spar's business in Poland. Yes, they have a business in Poland. And Mondi getting out of Russia, beginning to at least, in a bit.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To David Peacock, who's a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. A better week than last week, better than the week before, and better than the week before that. There's almost a recovery building, we hope, David Peacock. And it's all to do with a little number on Tuesday that's changed the future of everything. 8% or 8.5% inflation in America versus 9.1%, and everybody suddenly relaxing about the world of investing again.
Yeah, Bruce, it certainly looks like the pressure's been taken off the market. So, yes, you're right. We've definitely seen a nice turnaround. In fact, this month to date, we've actually seen some really nice positive returns across the various sectors. Today, obviously, a little bit of profit-taking and possibly just letting a bit of pressure off. So our market a little bit easier today, but still a decent week that we had. And it's, you know, those inflation numbers and the sort of expectations on the Fed going forward, and our own local policy has also meant that the currency has strengthened quite nicely. So we're sort of sitting at around sort of 16.20 to the dollar and 16.64 to the euro. So decent moves all around, and let's hope that this continues for some time still.
We certainly do. The trouble with this inflation story in the United States, it doesn't mean that prices are falling. It just means they are rising at a terrifying rate, which is just a little bit slower than the really, 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 really scary rate of inflation that was there last month. And this is the thing that's freaking me out. It's almost as if the inflation issue is dead and buried and not worth worrying about anymore. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case.
I would agree with you, Bruce. I would say that level of 8.5% clearly is very high from a very long-term perspective. So if you look at when we chatted last week, if you look at the employment numbers and rising wages that are coming through, particularly in the United States, you know, clearly that is going to have an impact in terms of keeping inflation at these sort of levels. Obviously, the other side of it is the fact that we've got this oil price that's just sort of currently under $100 on Brent, you know, at the moment. And obviously the feed through that has in terms of, for example, fertilizer, soft commodities, etc. So on the one side, yes, we are seeing that there is potentially more cash chasing product. On the other side, it looks like the main commodities that have been chased in the last while seem to be easing back a little bit. So obviously we're going to have to see what the Fed's next move is, and more specifically what their view is on where they see rates going forward from here.
Couple of big stories today. Mondi beginning the process of an exit from Russia. Now, this has taken a while, but they found a buyer for one of their most significant businesses. It's 1.5 billion euros worth of business. This is a huge deal for Mondi, cutting ties with Russia.
Yeah, it's been some time in coming, and unfortunately, Mondi has been an incredibly consistent allocator of capital. So the situation with Russia clearly was an issue. They said that they were not going to rush the sale, but ultimately it looks like they are hopefully going to conclude a deal that looks like about sort of 1.7 billion euros, which effectively relates to about 61 rand per share. So, you know, there's obviously, this is quite an important deal, and it's going to take some time. So obviously the Russian government needs to approve it. We're then obviously going to have to convert the cash into hard currency. So while it's obviously very, very good news, I think it's going to take some time for this thing to ultimately feed through into the company. So from that perspective, you know, we see that the sort of valuation has moved up quite nicely now, above 400 rand. And from that perspective, you know, we think this is actually a very, very positive move for the company.
Excellent. And then Poland has been a big problem for Spar. Spar in South Africa owns a couple of different operations across the world, including one in the UK, one in Ireland that spreads into the UK. There's Switzerland and Poland, and they've lost a huge number of their stores in Poland, only 11% of turnover, but it feels like they're really taking Poland by the neck and shaking it out to turn it around.
Yeah, Bruce, you'll recall that, those businesses were almost under or were under a form of business rescue. And just as the management team was trying to get involved in sorting that out, we had COVID that kicked in. So that unfortunately delayed everything by a couple of years. And as they were about to start moving back in and reviewing, the Russian-Ukraine conflict also happened. So you're right, in terms of the group, it looks like sort of 91 retailers were served notice. It looks like about 58 are going to leave the Spar group. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have left for good. There is a chance that they may, in fact, come back into the group again. But I think this is a very positive move. We saw the share price moving up quite nicely today. It was up sort of 4% along with a number of the other companies that are going through sort of corporate actions at the moment. So again, you know, this unlocks some decent value in the company. Good. And from that perspective, we should see some decent upside in the share price.
David Peacock, Portfolio Manager at Sunlum Private Wealth.
Fitness News Sport.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Sustainable finance for growing places. The bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. In a moment, our Friday file, we'll be talking functional sculpture. this evening. That's what we're doing. On the next Money Show, the new chief executive at Absa, one of the longest serving executives in banking, a guy called Ari Rotenbach, will take us through financial results. We'll also have a business book review from Graham Codrington. He's a futurist. He's taking us through The Man Who Broke Capitalism, how Jack Welch gutted the heartland and crushed the soul of corporate America. Ooh, he was grumpy one day when I cut him off at a conference because he was talking rubbish. Yeah, he was. And that's what's coming up next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Nandipa Mtambo is an artist. Nandipa is a sculpturalist. Nandipa started, as I understand it, as a taxidermist. Nandipa, do you just fill me in a little bit on the background here as to how you got into taxidermy?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show. Well, I didn't really start off in taxidermy. I was interested in forensic pathology when I was younger. So I had initially thought that I would become a forensic pathologist, but then became a sculptor. And through the process of sculpture, then discovered taxidermy, which is what led me to where I am now.
My goodness gracious me. I mean, forensic pathology, if you watch the TV shows and they get the skull and they take the plasticine that you get in kids' playgrounds and stuff, and they sort of layer it on the bones and recreate the images. I suppose that in a form is sculpture in a way. They're sort of sculpting using the basis of the skull to create an image of somebody who was once alive. There's a connection, I think.
I think for me, strangely, the connection is around organic material and how to use a chemical process to understand something about that organic space. So I was more interested in the fact of possibly how somebody died, what happened in the decomposition. So I was more interested in the kind of background of how death happens rather than a reconstruction.
That takes you to taxidermy. And taxidermy, we don't think as a massively specialized job. It's taking the carcass of an animal generally and preserving it. And I think it's a huge industry. I mean, you just got to go to Limpopo and places like that, northwest, where there are lots of game farms, and every second property seems to be a taxidermist. How long did you sort of stay in that trade for?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I went to UCT. I studied fine art. So I have my undergraduate and my master's from there. And UCT's campus is right next to the Natural History Museum. And so at the time, I suppose because I was struggling around how to think around sculpture, what material I wanted to use, and cowhide was the thing that kind of came to me at that time. I then walked over, literally, and asked them to help me with understanding taxidermy. So my kind of introduction was trying to understand how to preserve the animal hide. And so they allocated me a taxidermist to help me with this. And then how I kind of moved through the space is to make, I guess, life-size models or mannequins of myself, and then stretch this cowhide over that mannequin. And because of the process that I was taught, I was able to kind of make these life-size, hairy women, essentially.
Okay. So. Is there much of a market for life-size, hairy women in animal hide?
You would be surprised. You know, the Zeitz Museum in Cape Town bought a whole show of mine. I won Standard Bank Young Artist as well in this process of making life-size hairy ladies. And the Zeitz Museum bought a whole show. I have my works in a lot of collections in international galleries, international museums. Even in local homes, there are people who have my work.
And now, I mean, the thing that's grasped our attention is this idea of functional sculpture. And so you're not a million miles away from where you have been. You're beginning to make furniture using animal hide. And again, that's not unusual. We sit on leather couches all the time. Yours, however, is fundamentally different in that you are actually sculpting the hides into shapes, almost like you're part of the animal, I suppose, if you sit in an armchair of animal skin.
Yeah, I guess because of my training in sculpture and thinking around the body and how the body functions, the kind of move into the space of functional sculpture was interesting for me. I partnered with Southern Guild, who have a space in Cape Town, and they were so interested in the fact that I work in animal hide, and they have partnerships with people who understand leather work and upholstery. And so what I did is that I looked back into some of, because, you know, I'm trained as a sculptor, but I work in painting, drawing. So looking back in my career and thinking around how to recreate a drawing, for instance, into something one can sit in, or recreate a painting into something one can lie in. So it was a really interesting process of them having to stretch their imaginations and me looking back into all the work that I've done over the years and how to marry the two.
It's an extraordinary sort of interpretation, I suppose, of organic material. Do you ever see yourself sort of going into mass manufacturing for a chain of any description, or is it all bespoke once-off pieces? Do you take orders, for example?
Well, yeah, we take orders. I mean, I think right now the interesting thing is that these kind of collaborations take time. You know, Southern Guild and I had been talking over 7 years, for instance, sure, around how we could create a collaboration, what it would mean, who would get in as a third or a second party. And so the kind of creative space around having a clear idea that everybody in the collaboration understands in the same way is a process in itself. And so I think for me, there are certain pieces that could be manufactured on a larger scale, but others that I think are more bespoke. So it would be a combination of the two.
Nandipa, thank you very, very much for chatting this evening. Functional art or functional sculptures, Nandipa Mtambo. She's been displayed in galleries all over the place and, yeah, wanted to be a forensic pathologist. There's a career change for you if you've ever had one. Thank you, Nandipa, very, very much indeed. Telkom, being the Brutal Biz quiz now, by the way, we've moved on. Telkom is very, very popular at the moment. MTN wants to buy it. Rain wants to merge with it. Who wants to take over government's stake? Name of a rock band, 1980s? Maybe that's where they got the name of the company. I'd like to know the name of the company where the rains come down in Africa. But yeah, Rain wants to merge with Telkom. MTN wants to buy it. But another company where the rains come down in Africa, that company, it wants to buy government's stake in Telkom. Telkom is proving exceptionally popular at the moment. Who is the third player looking to take up a stake in Telkom? That is your first question in tonight's Brutal Biz Quiz. You can give us a call on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Give us a shout. Let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday night.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's see whether or not you will win or whether I will prevail this evening as we play the Brutal Biz Quiz. Telkom, very popular. MTN wants to buy it. Rain wants to merge with it. Who wants to take over government's stake? Robert in Joburg South.
Hi, good evening, Bruce. Toto Consortium.
Toto Consortium is 100% accurate. Well done. Telkom is in talks of a possible takeover by MTN. Now, Rain into the fray yesterday, then they got told that they'd illegally issued a statement and they shouldn't have done so. And now we see that Toto Consortium is wanting to buy government's stake in Telkom. The communications minister, though, saying that there's no plan to sell the stake in Telkom at the moment. It's an interesting standoff, and no doubt there'll be one or two or three or four other pitches, of course, on this particular business. There is a pizza company. It failed for a second time in South Africa in March this year, and it's now failed in Italy as well. Which pizza company has done that?
Yes, Bruce, it's a pizza company,
Don't say sorry. And that's the trouble. You see, you don't even recognize the brand. Maybe that's why it didn't work out. It started out as Scooter's Pizza in South Africa. Then Taste Holdings brought this international franchise to the country. And they thought, you know what, if we stick an international label on our already delicious and very successful pizzas, it'll work better. And it didn't. And then they had to give away a whole bunch of the money that they were making on the pizza away in royalties. And it was a pity. Now, this particular pizza brand, which you think it's crazy. I mean, you make a pizza which is, you know, not that lecker. There are better pizzas in the world. And you take it to where pizza was invented and you think, you know, we're going to teach them how to suck eggs. Got a lesson this week. Andile in four ways. Andile, which pizza company has failed in Italy?
I think it's Scooter's.
No, it used to be called Scooter's in South Africa. It's a global pizza business. Probably the biggest pizza company in the world, or alleged pizza company in the world. Mike and Rosebank?
Domino's.
Domino's, absolutely. The dominoes are falling. It just hasn't worked in Italy. Not surprising, really. Which media company has booted Netflix off the number one spot in terms of it being the biggest streaming service to subscribers globally?
Disney.
Exactly. People said it was a Mickey Mouse company, but no, it's not a Mickey Mouse company. It's Disney. Absolutely right, George. George, applause, please. We can't continue without applause. On the business. Thank you, George. Johnson & Johnson will stop selling what in 2023?
Vaccine.
No. They'll probably do stop that sooner. Faisal in Houghton, what's Johnson & Johnson going to be selling, stop selling by 2023?
The only thing I could think of is baby powder.
Baby powder, absolutely right. The talcum-based baby powder. Rumors started about 2 years ago that this baby powder contained asbestos and was causing ovarian cancer. And Johnson & Johnson just can't fight against fake news. And so they've taken what they call a commercial transition to transition all of its baby powder products to use cornstarch instead of talcum powder. And I wonder how that is going to change the way in which this works. True or false, the CEO of a marketing startup called Hyper Social posted crying selfies of himself on LinkedIn after firing some of his employees.
Sorry, Bruce, repeat the question.
Brandon Wallaker, the chief executive of a Columbus company, a company based in Columbus in the United States called Hyper Social. Did he or did he not post crying selfies after he fired staff?
Yes, he did.
He most certainly did, Faisal, and that makes you the whiz of the biz quiz this evening. How pathetic. How pathetic. You know, if you're going to fire people, that's, you know, it's tragic and it's awful. But don't go looking for sympathy. You're not the one who's lost their job. The staff have lost their job. Another interesting story this week, by the way, and well done to you, Faisal. McDonald's announcing plans to start reopening outlets in Ukraine. They closed after Russia's invasion in March. And then, of course, McDonald's has sold its Russia business, doesn't want to be involved with those people. Now it's saying that it'll help restore a small but important sense of normalcy in Ukraine. There'll be a phased reopening over several months in Kyiv and in western Ukraine in areas deemed safe. McDonald's had 100 restaurants in Ukraine before the war started, before the invasion started. It's not a war, it's an invasion and a self-defense mechanism. Companies continue to pay wages, it says, to more than 10,000 staff since then. But yeah, McDonald's reopening in in that particular country. And then the funniest thing I found, let me share this with you before we go to Eyewitness News, and also this evening to the best bits of The Money Show, which include our shapeshifter and a whole bunch of other good things. So do stay tuned for that. But an advert in an Australian newspaper, you've never heard of it. It's called McKay and Witt Sunday Life. And Jenny is very, very irritated with Steve. Jenny and Steve were together. But Steve was naughty, so Jenny took out an ad in the McKay and Witt Sunday Life newspaper. Dear Steve, I hope you're happy with her. Now the whole town will know that you're a filthy cheater. From Jenny. P.S. I bought this ad using your credit card. Well done, Jenny.